This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. How do the living deal with the bodies of the dead, with the mortal remains? That's the question at the center of the book, The Work of the Dead, by my guest Thomas LeCour. He writes about how burial and cremation customs evolved over the centuries. LeCour is a professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also the author of the book, Making Sex, Body and Gender from the Greeks to Freud. Thomas LeCour, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with the story of your great-great-great-great-grandfather's tombstone, because that story relates to your book.
So I basically learned about my great-great-great-grandfather's tombstone from my cousin Walter LeCour, who had been researching the history of the family. And because of what I learned from him, when I was giving a lecture in what used to be called Breslau, which was then in Germany and is now called Wrocław and is in Poland, I visited the grave first of my great-grandfather, which is in the only intact German cemetery in that city, which is the Jewish cemetery. And then my host drove us about 30 or 40 kilometers to the east to this hillock in the middle of potato fields with a manor house in the middle of the nearby village and a Protestant church at one end and a Catholic church at the other end and a small Jewish cemetery. And in that small Jewish cemetery, I found the grave of this man who was born David ben Eliezer and who took the name LeCour and who was the first person with that name and therefore my first known ancestor.
And he was a rabbi. And the question
is,
how did this tombstone survive for so long?
It's such an interesting question how the tombstone survived. And there are a few machine gun holes in it or bullet holes. But the cemetery in general is intact, which I thought was rather moving. And I was moved by seeing it and in some sense by his voice speaking, because the tombstone sort of speaks in his voice and proclaims who he is. Of course, it's in Hebrew and I don't know Hebrew, so it's a student of mine who translated that for me. But I knew that the tombstone was speaking and that in some sense he was speaking.
We take for granted that there are cemeteries in which a lot of people are buried, in which we can mm-hmm. be buried if we choose to be. Mm-hmm. But there weren't always cemeteries like that. There were churchyards in which people were buried. So how far back does the cemetery as we know it date back to?
So on the one hand, it dates back to Greek antiquity. On the other hand, it dates back to 1801. And the reason for this disjuncture is because one of the most important, maybe the most important aspect of the rise of Christianity and the end of paganism is the church's claim over the dead. And the church's claim over the dead is to pray for the dead and to care for their souls, but to take care of their bodies. And so starting very early on, Christians came to be buried first next to martyrs and then around churches, and then churches got relics. So the creation of the churchyard is really a sign of the end of the pagan regime in which families cared for the dead and buried them generally in cemeteries, and the rise of this new religion and the creation of a new community of the dead, which is to say the community of the Christian dead buried around something holy. So then if we fast forward to the late 18th century in the French Revolution, the French revolutionaries say, no, we want to unmake that history. We want to recreate the classical account of the body and what the bodies mean to families and what the bodies mean to the state and to communities. And they created the first cosmopolitan community of the dead, which was Père Lachaise, which was explicitly not a churchyard. That is to say, it was explicitly not just for Christians. It was explicitly cosmopolitan. The Russian could lie next to the Spaniard, the Jew next to the Christian. So the cemetery as a landscape feature and as a place for a new kind of community of the dead is really a creation of the French Revolution and its rejection of the history of the making of the churchyard.
So Père Lachaise cemetery in Paris, which you just described as being the first cemetery of its kind, that's a tourist attraction now. Among the people buried there are like Balzac, Chopin, Oscar Wilde, Proust, Jim Morrison.
Yes.
How did it change how people were buried? I mean, it was not only a question of like the landscape and the place, but probably also the rituals surrounding the burial, the marking of the grave.
Well, of course. The first thing you remember is that the churchyards are pretty small. And in Paris, the main burial place was not a churchyard, but a large sort of urban landscape where Les Halles is now, the market. And there were almost no monuments, and it was a mess. And bodies after bodies after bodies were piled in churchyards and in these other sorts of spaces. So they were in disarray. We shouldn't imagine the 18th century churchyard or any kind of 18th century burial place as these tidy little churches that we think of today. So you're right. There were very few monuments in churchyards. There was lumpy ground. There was room only for funerals of people whom the church wished to bury. So the Jim Morrisons of the world would probably not have been buried in these cemeteries. So in a way, you got to think the cemetery is a kind of whole new stage for creating communities of the dead.
In America, my knowledge of early burials comes from watching movie and TV westerns, so I know I'm very informed about this, and my knowledge from that is that people had land, and because they're westerns, people had land and they buried loved ones in the backyard, out in the prairie or the wilderness or whatever, and they'd mark it with a cross or whatever. But what can you tell us about early burials in the U.S.?
Well, you're absolutely right. In these great open spaces of America, without any particular historical markings, people buried their dead on their farms. They buried them along the migration trails. But as soon as America became settled, they built cemeteries. So in my part of the world, in San Francisco, Colma, which was explicitly modeled on Père Lachaise, was opened in 1854. So almost as soon as San Francisco becomes a city, it has a place for the burial of its dead. And Boston, again, modeling its cemetery, Mount Auburn, explicitly on Père Lachaise with some variation, sees this as sort of Boston coming into its own as a great 19th century city. And I could point to Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn and in fact, all over America. So as Americans settled, as they created cities, they produced cities of the dead.
The idea of a cemetery kind of democratizes burial because you didn't have to be Christian, you didn't have to be in good standing with the church. On the other hand, it turns it into a more kind of capitalistic class system because you're buying your way in. you're buying the prestige spots, you're buying the view. And as you point out in the book, the idea of, a final resting place with a view comes into practice with the cemetery. You want the place by the little stream or on the hill or under the tree.
You're absolutely right that the cemetery is in many ways considerably less democratic than the churchyard. At the same time, it's also more democratic in the sense that anyone can be buried there, as you say. But the poor are invisible. And in 18th century churchyards, the poor may not have tombs, but the lumpy ground testifies to the fact that they're there. And that was important to how people imagined the churchyard. So the real shift in the cemetery is, yes, the prosperous can buy the more beautiful spots and the poor in some ways not there. On the other side, all sorts of political communities and alternative religious communities and others could create a space of their own dead in a cemetery, which wasn't possible in the churchyard. So on the one hand, it is a place for the prosperous. On the other hand, it's also an open kind of place, a kind of palette, if you will, in which the bodies of a great variety of the dead can speak to the living.
With churchyards, they're not very big. And I know you said, in previous centuries, churchyards were much bigger than what we're imagining now. But still, how many people could you accommodate
there? Well, they're not much bigger. Let me correct you. They weren't very much bigger. The churchyards were small.
Oh, okay.
And so, vastly crowded.
Yeah. So were people just like interred on top of each other? Were they recycled to make room for like more fresher bodies?
That's absolutely right. The dead were recycled. The churchyard is packed full of bodies. And in some churchyards, the ground is 2-3 meters above its original level because of bodies. And the famous gravedigger scene in Hamlet, where they're digging up the body, is a literary example of that, in which another body goes in the ground and one body comes up. So churchyards were really...
I didn't know that. The Alaspar Yorick, I knew him well scene?
Yes, exactly. So these were constantly being turned over. And in fact, until the 17th century, people generally didn't have coffins. So the bodies were put in, they decayed, and then more come along. And if you look at the churchyards, as I said earlier, they're lumpy. And every 100 years or so, they flatten the ground and dig up some bones and they put some more bodies in and then they become lumpy again. So these things have been around for 600 or 700 years. There are thousands of bodies there. They're a mess.
Again, I get a lot of my knowledge from movies. So in several films, the characters worry that they're going to be poor, they're going to not have enough money for burial, and they'll be buried in Potter's Field. I used to think that there was a cemetery for the poor called Potter's Field. I think that's probably not true, but what was the meaning of the Potter's Field, and why were people in such fear of being buried in a Potter's Field?
Well, there are in some places not called literally Potter's Fields, but there are places where people are buried in the aggregate. I think the interesting thing to me is that the fear is less where the poor were buried. The fear is having an ignominious funeral. The fear is being taken there in an ignominious way. So what the poor save for more than anything else, starting in the late 18th and the 19th century, is a proper funeral. That is to say, a casket with little angels nailed to it, a proper cart, perhaps a horse with a plume. In other words, in some sense, that the dead body is still treated as if it were part of culture. The actual place of burial, that is to say, in a common part of the cemetery, didn't seem to bother people as much. But I think where you're right, and it's, what's interesting, is that the fear of an indecent funeral, of a pauper funeral, increases, I think, with the commercialization of death, both with the grandness of bourgeois funerals and with the fact that they really would be invisible in the cemetery. So in the 18th century, the whole operation was smaller. You die, you're buried in the churchyard. There wasn't this big public nature of it. In the 19th century, when your body had to go from your house to a cemetery, you know, on a donkey cart, it was awful. So poor people freed slaves. All sorts of people cared deeply about this. They belonged to burial clubs and box societies, they were called in England, and did all sorts of things to save enough money for being properly buried.
Since your book has so much to do with, like, you know, death and the burial practices and the way we treat the dead and the history of how people have wanted to be treated themselves when they died, it's interesting to note, as you do in your book, that your father was a pathologist and that he worked on autopsies. He had to prepare organs for microscopic examinations to determine the cause of death. And you watched him do that. So what impact did it have on you to see the organs of the dead, to see your father handling body parts of the dead?
I don't know how psychoanalytic to be about this. I mean, the point is really that, you know, I lived in a family in which the dead were present. My father left dinner table to do autopsies, and as you say, I watched him prepare what he had taken from the bodies. My feeling is that my father regarded the dead very routinely in a way a mortician might regard them. He was interested in them scientifically. I never heard my father speak about the fact that his body mattered. But one of the things that surprised me in my own relationship to dead bodies is my relationship to his dead body. And so there was a time in 1995 I was going to Germany to give a talk. And my wife suggested that I take some of the ashes of my father and that I put them on the grave of my grandfather, who was also a doctor and was buried in Hamburg. And I knew this grave because my grandmother, who lived with us, had a picture of the tombstone on her desk. And so I told my wife that, look, we don't have any ashes of my father. I'd scattered them in a flower bed, and consequently there were no ashes. And she said, we'll take some dirt. And I said, well, if I take dirt, this microscopic, homeopathic bit of ash is no different than the fertilizer that we put in the flower bed. No, no, she said, take it. So I made a little Ziploc bag, and I took some of this dirt, and I took it, and I put it on my grandfather's grave. And it was very moving to me. It was sort of my father being returned to Germany after having been forced into exile by Hitler. And on the one hand, I heard my father's voice saying, this is Unsinn, as he would have said, this is nonsense. On the other side, on the other hand, I didn't believe it to be nonsense. And so I found myself a completely secular person, somehow moved by returning something which I had made myself believe to be part of him to Germany. So it could be more in reaction to my father's totally materialist account of the dead that I've become interested in this tension between the dead as something purely material and the dead as so culturally important.
Well, it's interesting, too. You know, we've been talking about burial practices over the centuries and how people visit graves. And both of your parents were cremated. So you have no graves to visit for your parents, although you have visited the grave of your grandfather and your great-great-great-great-grandfather. And visiting those graves meant something to you. Do you feel the absence of a grave for your parents?
I should feel the absence of a grave for my parents, but in fact, I imagined a grave. My mother's ashes were spread on a lake in Virginia where she loved to swim. And I imagine her swimming very early morning with the mist still rising on the lake. And I imagine her to be there. And my father's ashes, I just spoke, was in this flower bed, and I moved some of this dirt from the flower bed. So in my imagination, I know where they are. And that's, again, this sort of strange cultural magic that we work to make the dead meaningful.
Did your parents discuss with you their decision to be cremated?
No, I think it was taken for granted that they would be cremated. And I think that's something that's a view that goes back to the early 20th century when Reformed Jews in Germany, Jews who regard themselves as modern and scientific, opted for cremation in disproportionate numbers. In fact, Reformed Jews in Italy and in Switzerland likewise opted for cremation as a sign of modernity. And so I assumed that that's what my parents would want, but we've never discussed it.
So it was your decision to cremate them. They didn't tell you.
It was my decision.
Do you want to be cremated, may I ask?
I do. I'm just kind of assuming I'm going to be cremated, yes.
Because?
Well, because I suppose my parents were cremated. Because I think perhaps my wife and my daughter might want to scatter my ashes in different places that meant something to me. One of the beauties of cremation, it allows you to distribute the material remains of someone and imagine that person being at the same time in different places, which they can never be, of course, when they're alive. So I can imagine some of my ashes being spread in an apple orchard we have in the Santa Cruz Mountains. But I can imagine some being taken back to Virginia to that flower bed if they're still there. So I imagine it as making my body more divisible for those who come after me.
So it's interesting, even though you don't want to be buried and don't have that kind of, you're not placing that kind of value on your body or on burial, you're still placing symbolic significance on your ashes and what happens to those remains.
I am still doing that. And I think I share that with lots of people. I mean, the striking thing is how much we, not just in the West, but in other places of the world, care about these paltry remains of the human body and how important it is that they're there or that they're not there. I mean, the controversy now in France is what to do with the bodies of terrorists who died in the police responses to them. And in some sense, you said, who cares? They're just ashes. And yet people care deeply. So in that sense, we do make ashes just as we made bodies, something special, despite the fact that they're so little.
So in the spirit of death and sex, I'm going to change the subject from the topic of your new book, How We Take Care of Our Dead, to the subject of an earlier book, a book called Solitary Sex, which was basically a history of taboos against masturbation. Why did you want to investigate that?
Well, I think I give you two reasons. I mean, the more general reason, and a reason that ties these two books together, is that much of my work in the last 20 or 30 years and my interest is how humans give meaning to their bodies. And so a taboo against solitary sex, and at a very different level, giving meaning to a dead body are sort of part of the same project. But the specific historical reason I was interested in this is that it was puzzling. That is to say, all of a sudden in the 18th century and then dramatically more in the 19th century, doctors and religious people, but also secular people and educators all began to think that solitary sex was just awful. It was morally awful, but it was also dangerous. It was medically dangerous. And so I thought, really? This should start at a particular time? And I could actually nail when it started. It started in 1712 with a little pamphlet. And that was a remarkable fact. And so I became interested in exploring, how is this possible? How is a taboo that everyone now knows about come into being when 300 years ago, no one would have given any thought?
What happened in 1712? What was this pamphlet?
Ah, I'm so glad you asked. In 1712, an anonymous writer, though I think I know who he is a surgeon named Martin, published a tract called Onania, which is taken from the name of Onan, who in Genesis 12 was struck down by God for spilling his seed on the ground. Now, never before the early 18th century did people connect Onan specifically with solitary sex. So this man publishes this pamphlet, and it says horrible things are going to happen if you do this, but I have the cure. And you can pick up this cure at any coffee house or at some of the drinking places. And he started advertising it widely, and people started buying it, and people started sending him letters. And this tract was translated, and there were copycat tracts. And so by the 1750s, this tract was being cited in the Encyclopédie, the great work of the French Enlightenment, in which the author said, look, this is a piece of trash, this work. On the other hand, this guy gets the credit for having brought this horrible thing to the attention of humanity. And so it grew through commercial networks. It grew because I think it played to very particular 18th century fears. But I'm absolutely sure that it starts then, because I know that these, especially to take early Christian thinkers or Jewish thinkers for that matter, who thought about the details of human sexuality in exquisite detail, didn't mention it. That's really surprising.
I have a book that I bought at a thrift store many years ago that I bought purely like for camp and irony. And it was called something like On Becoming a Man. And it had all kinds of like advice to, you know, boys on the verge of their teenage years. And among the advice were warnings. The warnings were really pretty dire. I don't remember exactly what they were, but, you know, bad things were going to happen. And this
very bad things were going to happen to you.
Yeah. And this book was from somewhere between the 1930s and the 1950s. I honestly don't remember. Mm-hmm. But to what extent do you think these prohibitions and these like medical fears are still passed on to people?
You know, it's so hard to say. I mean, do people still feel guilty about it? Is this still something we can't talk about? Probably so. And why that's the case and why there's so many jokes in popular culture about the objection of this act is peculiar. I mean, American Pie is an example. I mean, it's a joke in popular culture. Now, I should say, in some sense, it's always been a joke. It's not as if the ancients in the West and other parts of the world didn't know this existed. And it was usually a joke about the fact that, hey, you're so poor you can't afford a prostitute, or this is what women do when the guys are away, or some kind of – it was a joke. And that continues to be the case. It was in the early 18th century, this didn't become a joke. And very serious people like Rousseau, Kant, thought this was really emblematic of the worst possible moral act you could commit, really the worst possible. So that Rousseau goes on his most important book on how to bring up kids, saying, look, when your charge does something bad that you can see, you can correct them. But this is something they do in secret, and they develop this desire, and they feed this desire without your knowing anything about it. And soon they're caught up in this endless whirlpool of desire. They thought of it like addiction. And therefore, when a parent or a schoolmaster's charge starts being involved with this, it's the most dangerous thing that can happen. So it's just endless desire, endlessly not fulfilled, And it was connected in the late 18th century also to addiction, which is a new word roughly the same time that masturbation became a fear.
So as you pointed out, you think that the fear about solitary sex, as your book is titled, dates back to this pamphlet from the early 1700s.
I'm quite sure of that.
You're quite sure of that. Okay.
I'm quite sure of that.
And it connects this fear to the story of Onan in the Bible, where God punishes Onan because Onan spilled his seed. And that's always been interpreted, I think, or at least in the modern times has been interpreted as like God punished Onan for masturbating. Is there an alternate interpretation?
Oh, there are many alternate interpretations. I mean, as you can imagine, the rabbis have gone on and on about this. And the reason that God punished Onan is that Onan disobeyed his father, and Onan disobeyed the Levitical law to bear children with his dead brother's wife. So Onan was killed by God because he was disobedient. And the disobedient act was failure to engage in reproductive sex. Before the 18th century, no one thought that the specific act whereby Onan spilled his seed on the ground was what we would call masturbatory.
Okay. I've enjoyed talking with you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I've enjoyed talking with you. Thank you very much.
Thomas LeCour is the author of Solitary Sex and the new book, The Work of the Dead, A Cultural History of Mortal Remains. He's a professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley.